It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get reactions to the ruling striking down Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
First, it's time for our monthly check-in with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlag. Each month, she gives us a preview of the top stories in the latest issue of Discover.
The July-August issue hits newsstands tomorrow. The double issue is chock-full of cool science news. We've got a lot to talk about this afternoon, from dangerous ancient Roman toilets to a mystery at the center of the planet. Gemma Tarlak is senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you guys again.
Well, let's start. We talk politics on the show a lot, so let's look at this one. Midterm elections are coming up. You've got a story about a new voting system, some new technology. What's different about this?
Yeah, that's right. And I have to say, one of my favorite things about this story is the backstory to it. Mm. The county clerk in Austin, Texas, 3 years ago, got up at a computer security conference and challenged the people there at the conference to build her what she wanted. And they did. So it's called the Star Vote System. And there are a few different things about it. But to walk you through it very quickly, it's all about ensuring privacy, ensuring accuracy, and enabling easy verification by anyone, you, me, the politicians, the newspapers, etc. So you show up to vote, you get a token. Then, next step, you exchange that token for a unique number. That's basically your anonymous number to vote. You go and you vote, and then you verify, yes, this is how I want to vote. And then at home, or you know, in the newsroom or wherever you are, you can actually download all the encrypted votes. Privacy is still protected, but you can see the votes. Anyone can see them. Anyone can verify them, check the totals, etc. So it's kind of an exciting marriage of technology, privacy, and also just, hey, keeping them honest.
So you could go in and say, well, I'm 24601. Well, maybe not that number, but yeah, and that's how I voted.
So you can do that online, but also just anyone can look at the entire, you know, check the accuracy and verify the votes just in general. But yeah, there are a lot of different options to do it, and it's very transparent
and
while
how is
still
it,
protecting privacy.
How is it going over? Are people interested in implementing this thing?
Yeah, I think this is going to be kind of the test run for it. So we're going to see, but it looks really exciting, and I'm sure if it proves to be as easy and as private and as accurate as they're saying, I think it's going to catch on nationwide.
Well, Gemma, I'm a little confused. Have we ever had problem verifying votes in elections before?
I'd like to talk
a
little bit
about
the hanging chad. I can never tell when you're joking with me.
Oh, sorry. Too dry.
Okay.
Well, here's one that's fun to talk about. I don't know, fun to experience. I don't know. But we don't have to worry about it. Toilets in ancient Rome. You're fascinated by them, I hear, Gemma.
Not just ancient Rome. I will admit that when I've traveled, you know, pretty much around the world, and I've taken a lot of photos of toilets, and my friends think I have this weird thing about it. But to me, it's, you know, is there anything more universal than going to the bathroom? No. And everyone kind of has their different spin on it, you know, all different cultures, all different ages, et cetera. So we took a look at the toilet troubles of ancient Rome, which were really troublesome, trust me. I don't think I would want to try them out myself, basically because they were holes that, you know, were just lined up in these dark public areas, and they opened directly into the sewer channels. It was not uncommon to get bit by a rat while taking care of business. Also, methane could build up and explode. Not a good way to go. And there's like this whole subculture of gods and goddesses and, you know, special prayers and charms that people would have specifically for using the toilet in Rome.
And we see that in the archaeology of the Roman sewers and lavatories?
Yes. Now, here's kind of the funny thing. Believe it or not, there's this independent archaeologist who has made a career out of studying Roman toilets, and her name is Gemma as well.
Yeah.
I know.
It's a sign.
I know, right? Yeah, but Gemma Jansen has made her career out of studying the ancient toilets of Rome. Brave soul that she is.
Now, you said it wasn't just Rome. Do you see things like this elsewhere in the ancient world?
Yeah, well, you know, everywhere the Roman soldiers and the Roman army went, they took their roads and their toilets with them. So, you know, you do see a lot of similarities. For example, a few years ago, I was hiking Hadrian's Wall in northern England. There's a great Roman fort up there, and the toilets are still intact. And, yep, same idea.
I've seen here in the Midwest, people with log books or even entire joke books devoted largely to outhouse-related humor. What kind of things did the ancient Romans have? You mentioned gods and goddesses. Were they actually graffitiing prayers or tributes to gods and goddesses up on the walls?
Oh, not just graffiti. I mean, they had professional, beautiful mosaics. There's one of the goddess Fortuna, who is the goddess of luck, and she was a big presence in the toilet culture there. And they have a beautiful mosaic of her watching over a man getting things done.
So the Romans were great innovators. You'd think, you know, they built aqueducts and whatnot. You'd think they could come up with more than just praying for luck in the bathroom.
Right? And thank God we don't have to do that, right? Thank Fortuna we don't have to do that.
For sure. Well, it's hard to leave toilets behind.
But we must.
But we must. Let's go on to talk about another study. This one, there was a guy who was really interested in trying to figure out why he was a lousy singer. What did he do?
I love the scientific approach to the pain we've all experienced if we've ever gone to karaoke night, you know. Well, this guy, there's actually researchers who devote themselves to figuring out why people are terrible singers. And our writer went to them and said, help. They said basically bad singing involves a problem in one or more of three areas. The ability to keep time. Most of us have no problem with that. Something called note memory, which is both remembering the words to a song and how long to hold a specific note. And again, most of us have no problem with that. The big issue, pitch accuracy. And they find it's actually an issue of error correction in the brain. The fancy word for it is imitative deficit. And basically, if you sing the note wrong the first time, say you're aiming for a G and you hit an F sharp, right? Your brain just kind of imprints that F sharp. So every time you go for a G, even though you know you got to aim for that G and you know what it sounds like and you want to get there, your brain is like, no, let's do this one. So it's really hard to overcome. And actually, we have a bunch of really fun tests that you can try. We have the links to them right in the magazine. You can try to really see how much of an issue it is for you and whether you can kind of sing your way out of it.
And Gemma, you prepared a short solo to exhibit this for us, right?
Actually, it's an air guitar solo, and I'm doing it right now.
Oh, nice one.
Well, I would have thought my first guess would be it's in the vocal cords. You don't have the right musculature or something. That apparently
right.
is not the deal.
Yeah, and you know, for years in chorus, before I got kicked out for bad singing, they would make us do those exercises, you know, and it was specifically, oh, strengthen your vocal cords so you could hit the note better. That is all just, you know, no. It's your brain messing things up for you. Bad brain.
Is there a silver lining now that we sort of have a handle on what's happening when people can't sing? Can we correct it?
Well, there's the option of practice, practice, practice. But I just like the idea of having an official medical excuse. So, you know, next time I get booed off the stage doing a little Metallica at karaoke night, to be like, I'm sorry, I have imitative deficit.
Well, here's this one is a really hard science one that I found really interesting. We know so much about, you know, space, and we'll talk about exoplanets in a little bit. We know surprisingly little about what's going on just 7-8 miles and down below our feet inside the Earth. Why is it so hard to figure out what's down there?
Yeah, and you know, this is the kind of story that it's our cover story, by the way, for the issue. And it's the kind of story that you go into it thinking, oh, the Earth's core, they settled that years ago, didn't they? And then the more you read, the more you feel like a puny human who really has no idea what's going on. This is the center of our world, quite literally. We know very little about it. And that's for a number of reasons. I mean, it's really hard to get down there. Back during the Cold War, the Russians were committed to, yes, we will be the first to, you know, drill to the center of the Earth. And they had something called the Kola Super Deep Borehole out in the wilds of northwestern Russia. They were committed to it. They got about 7.5 miles down through the crust, and said, yeah, it's not working. And that's as far as they got. So that's like the deepest we've been in the crust. And you know what? That's not even halfway through the crust. And basically, if the Earth was an apple, we would not have even pierced the skin. So
wow.
There's a lot we simply can't access. We simply don't know. We kind of have to guess. And a lot of the previous theories, one by one, they've been proven wrong, including some of the most recent, that, you know, they actually realized if the Earth's center worked the way we thought it worked, our planet would pretty much explode. So they're trying to figure out, well, how does it work? And a lot of the issue has to do with how heat is conducted from the center of the Earth and, you know, exactly what's going on in the middle. And also, that's partly responsible for how our magnetic field is created and a lot of other aspects that make life on Earth possible. So it's really kind of a, you know, you think, oh, center of the Earth, okay, whatever, but then you realize it has all these implications, including, you know, enabling you and me to be alive.
Well, we're talking right now about some of the coolest news from the world of science with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak. We're continuing our discussion with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak about the top science stories in the latest issue, which hits newsstands tomorrow.
And Gemma, before we climb out of the Kola borehole in Siberia, it was interesting. Part of the reason they stopped digging was that at about 7 miles down, it got really hot and the crust started behaving differently. What happened?
Yes. And, you know, it's just not some place you want to be because we just don't have the technology to make it down there. And it actually, they had a lot of problems drilling in a straight line, even just because of how it was screwing up their tools and the hole itself. So it's a really interesting story, a little bit too complex for me to get into in a couple minutes, but definitely worth a read.
But the stone got plasticky and was filling in the hole as they dug?
Yes. That's why the hole kept kind of wiggling around and not going in a straight line.
So my backyard hole to China just isn't going to work with my shovel.
You should keep going on it.
Yeah,
then.
I will. Never give up.
Well, Gemma, there is also a feature in the new magazine about scientists who immerse themselves in 3D dimensional environments. And the deeper you go in this, it sounds like science fiction that we're involved in here. But this is happening. What's going on with this?
Well, you know, the more involved we get with research, the deeper we go, the more granular our study of variety of fields, whether it be hurricane or the human body, the deeper we go, the more data we're collecting, the more data we're amassing. And it's getting to the point where scientists are having a really hard time kind of keeping track of all the data, visualizing it, making those connections that are out there to further their research just in the data. So they're creating these enormous 3D environments, like you said. It's kind of like being in a 360 IMAX theater, and you're on a catwalk that kind of goes right through the middle, and it allows you to visualize the data. So they have people doing everything from looking at these compiled high-res images of the moon and being able to see different topographies that were not immediately apparent otherwise. They have other people who are just, other researchers are going into the circulatory system. They have a hurricane environment that allows you to see the storm using the data points that are collected and plotted. You're seeing the storm in a way you never could just staring at a computer screen. And it's allowing scientists to really flex their creativity and increase their understanding of what the data in front of them actually means, instead of looking at screen after screen after screen of numbers.
Well, is this at a point yet where, say, they could take images of a person, you know, with a medical problem and then get an inside view looking around for abnormalities?
You're thinking Fantastic Voyage, aren't you?
I am exactly, yes, thinking Fantastic Voyage without having to shrink anybody.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's Fantastic Voyage without the pesky shrinking issue. And that's basically what it is. And, you know, there are several different immersive environments around the country that are doing this, and they're all doing them in slightly different ways. So what each is able to do, it varies. It's, you know, one has a specialty in one area, another in another. But, yeah, I mean, that's where we're heading. You know, pretty soon the doctor, instead of just putting your X-ray up on that little light board in the exam room, they may have a X-ray of your lungs 200 feet high that they could pinpoint all these things they hadn't seen before.
Sounds a little invasive.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, let's take
a
stroll down
your
esophagus. Yeah.
Waiter, there's a doctor in my store. Never mind. Let's move on because there's so much cool stuff. This is a double issue of Discover. And what I want to talk about is the naming of exoplanets, which has created a bit of a controversy in the astronomy world. What's at issue here?
Yeah, and people get really passionate about this. There's an organization called the International Astronomical Union, and they've kind of been the ones to deal with naming new exoplanetary items out there, you know, moons and such, everything, the whole nine yards. And they come up with these really kind of dry, you know, HD 855-12b. Okay, that's all right, whatever. But there's this other organization, UINGO, that says, hey, let's all have the right to name something. So they're, you know, pushing the popular names. So, you know, pretty much you can, you know, name a planet whatever you want. And then there are nicknames for planets. For example, there's a planet orbited by two suns that, of course, everyone is calling Tatooine after.
Yeah,
Luke Skywalker's home. And then there's the question, okay, so we've got Mars, we've got Neptune. Those are all Greco-Roman mythology. What about using other world mythologies, whether it be Norse or Swahili? You know, let's branch out a little from Greco-Roman. So there's this huge controversy and discussion about what are we going to name all these exoplanets we're finding? And people feel really passionately on the topic.
Is the scientific community weighing in on the boring but functional, you know, series of letters and numbers for the most part?
Yeah. There's the series of letters and numbers. That's the way the International Astronomical Union does it. But there's also an argument for something called exoplanetary taxonomy, which is kind of similar to the Linnaean classification system we use for, you know, phylum, class, order, family, et cetera, all the way down to species. And so those are the kind of the number folks who want to go in one of those two directions. And then there are the people who are saying, no, let's name it after variety of gods. Or, hey, let's name it whatever we want. Let's name it Bob's Planet. Who cares? And so it's, you know, it's kind of the, I see it as kind of like the skiers versus the snowboarders, that debate, you know, that was raging a couple decades ago. Like, do we go down the slope the way our forefathers did, or do we play loud music and wear baggy pants? It's kind of the same approach.
And I suppose the more we know about the universe, the more of these exoplanets we're going to find, it might become impractical to name everything.
Well, there are thousands of them out there that we already know about, and they're finding more every month. So, yeah, we're going to run out of gods and goddesses real soon. And, you know, if I could get some speck of dust in the universe named after me, yeah, sure. I'm all for that.
But in a kind of serious note, do you capture the imagination of kids with a TT384B or with Osiris, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, but, you know, the question is, okay, do you capture the imagination of kids or do you reflect something about the actual planet? And that's, you know, if you go the taxonomic route, you're in the name itself is embedded kind of the location, the planet type, planet size, and everything. So it's kind of which way do you want to go? Do you want to, you know, appeal to the kids or kind of make it clear for researchers to have a way to organize these things?
One more topic before we get out of here. 20 things we didn't know about play. We don't have to get through all 20, but what kind of things do we take for granted when it comes to playtime?
Well, super quick, let's go. Let's start with human and end with bears. Humans, children will play anywhere. They have documented children playing in war zones and concentration camps. It's just such an innate part of us. And not just us. They did a study on wild brown bears in Alaska and found out, for reasons they're not quite sure, the more the bears played, the more likely they were to survive into adulthood. And they think it may give them a behavioral edge, but they think roughhousing and wrestling around, rolling in the mud, may actually expose them to more bacteria that strengthens their immune system. So all the different aspects of play are just fascinating, and we're just starting to understand what they are.
And not just bears, dolphin, and there were some strange insect that practiced having sex first or played at having sex. It does seem to have some kind of biological function.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of training for adulthood in a lot of different ways.
Gemma, any play plan for this weekend?
Actually, I'm car shopping.
Oh, that sounds more like work.
I know. There's nothing fun about that, I got to say.
All right. We'll leave it there. Gemma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Always great to be with you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us each month to bring us up to date on some of the coolest, most interesting, or most playful topics from the worlds of science.